All right, here are the three things that I think you should be knowing about today. Fair and free elections, free speech, checks and balances. These are the things that I, as an American, grew up with. They're principles, right? In the Constitution. But there's a Chinese thought leader who's coming out and says, it's all bogus. The EU, Europeans, countries disintegrating. NATO falling apart. I'm not saying this. I'll tell you who is. Oh, and by the way, in France, another cog has fallen into place along the lines of those arguments. Then in the United States, more and more Americans are suddenly coming out and they're saying their government is lying about Charlie Kirk's murder. Are they right? We're going to put those through the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's go look at recent history so we can understand better what's happening. First came, as you know, the charges against Mr. Trump. Most Americans believed it was a legal vendetta, right? They didn't believe it. They didn't trust it. Then came Epstein. And on that one, Americans are almost universally convinced now that they are being lied to, big time, by their government. Then there were these wars, right, that American taxpayers are shelling out money for to the tune of billions of dollars. Billions with a B. And what do Americans get for these billions of dollars they're giving up? Zero. Nothing. They're getting nothing in return. Which is why, when it comes to Israel and Ukraine in particular lately, a lot of Americans are saying, I'm tired of being taken advantage of. Then comes the Charlie Kirk murder. At first, I thought the doubts that people were putting out there were simply, a normal reaction to a horrible video killing. You know, people saw it for themselves right away. So that's why I think there was a lot of reaction. So I kind of stayed away from it, generally speaking, on this show and on my podcast and in my writings. But now, you know, it's starting to look to me like there's a nationwide feeling in America that they're doing it again. And by they, I mean the government, that they're lying again, that they're covering things up again. Are those who are saying that right? Let's look at this. By watching what people are saying. And not just any people. Let's listen to people who have some credibility with this.
The videos of him coming across the roof when he comes out from behind that building, see right there? When he gets to the edge of that white thing, if you look closely, the shadow before when he was on the dark portion of the roof, the shadow disappears. And then as you're, it's a little tough to see, but.
Yeah, I do. I see where there's a shadow there. I can see it even on the gravel, but now he gets to the white part. Where'd the shadow go?
Yeah, shadow disappears. And if you
look at that,
as he's starting to climb down off the roof, look in the background, you'll see this guy walking way back there in the background on the sidewalk. Then he disappears.
Holy crap. Yeah, Gary, run that back. Look at that.
So this video has been tampered with.
Wow. I had missed that part.
Yeah. So they're lying.
So they're lying, he says. They're lying. Those guys aren't your drunk neighbors who come over on weekends to your backyard barbecue and they just, you know, tell you some crazy opinions about some conspiracy. That's Larry Johnson, former CIA. Daniel Davis, former U.S. Army officer. The disappearing people on the video, the shadows that don't match up, by the way. Here's another one. Where's the rifle? How did he enter the campus carrying a rifle, walk around students and hundreds or thousands of people? Didn't they see him carrying a rifle? And where's the rifle on the video that they're sharing with us? Let's look at it again. Put it up, Gene, and you'll see. See where he's going to be coming to the end now? And he's climbing down. But you see how he's contorting his body to be able to jump now? The report says that he has a rifle with him at that point. Where is it? Because they say he later, after that, hid it in the woods. I mean, this is a 30-06. By the way, the 30 refers to the caliber. The term 6 refers to when it was invented, 1906. If you're wondering if he maybe has, you know, well, maybe he took it apart. Maybe he disassembled it, right? No. quickly disassembled rifles do exist. This is not one of them. So how did he do that, right? Here's another important point. If that were the rifle used, and it was indeed shot from the angle they're talking about and the position they say they were shooting from, and the bullet was 30 caliber, then Charlie Kirk's head would literally have blown off. I know, sounds horrible to say it, but that's what would have happened. Not a small hole on the side of his head as they're saying, but yeah, the bullet would have literally come out the other side. In fact, it seems every single person who has ever hunted with that rifle and every ballistics expert who's now gone public on this thing agrees that that wound that Charlie received does not match up with the caliber of bullet or the rifle. The FBI report says that Charlie's body stopped the bullet and it just stayed inside of him. Experts say impossible. And they're proving it on YouTube. That's the world we live in. Watch what happens when this hunter uses the same rifle at the hardest bone in the human body, the femur, the thigh bone, right? Thickest, impossible to break through. Watch what happens.
We're not only going to take a cow femur, but for anybody that says, wow, there's no meat, we're going to slap on a fat 4 inches of beef in front of the cow femur and see what happens.
And then give him thick skin like Nate.
All right, last test on the meat. Again, cow femur, bunch of beef, thick tape, and then we're going to move up to the steel. Here we go. Well. Well, everything exploded. All right, let's check it out. Cow femur. The damage to that.
Wow, did you see that? Not only did the bullet go through, it damn near exploded the whole thing, which is what experts say would have happened, unfortunately, to Mr. Kirk's head, his neck area, as horrible as that is to imagine, I know. Also, in the official report, U.S. officials say in their report that Charlie's neck, right? Charlie Kirk's neck was so strong, it was like steel. That's written in the report, the word steel. So, go to YouTube. Let's see what happens when that same bullet from the same distance using the same rifle is shot at steel, literal steel.
All right, so let's check out what 30-06 did to literal steel here. We have our, and thank God we got an actual competition shooter here to hit this 2-inch by 2-inch plate from 100 yards, which I probably wouldn't have been able to. Clean through 1/4-inch steel. Clean through 3/8-inch steel. And 1/2-inch steel almost, or actually it potentially did, actually blow out the side.
So it goes through steel, but it didn't go through Charlie's neck. This is what people are talking about. Videos like this are being shared by millions and millions of Americans. And again, the common theme is they just don't trust their government right now. And they especially don't trust the corporate-run media, who don't even bother to look into some of these inconsistencies. Let's talk a little more about the U.S. media. It's always one of my favorite subjects. But I got to tell you, I am a huge proponent, always have been, always, you've heard me say this, I am a huge proponent of free speech. Yes, I still believe in it. But is it working these days? Is it working in particular in the West? Look, from a practical standpoint, the answer is no. And look who's pointing this out again. Another Chinese thought leader is coming out and being extremely forthright, if not critical, with something very important to say about this. Let's take a listen.
If you look at unfettered internet speech, social media speech, you just have to look at America. Look at what's happening there. Okay, total polarization of society, total hostilities. There's no regard for facts, zero. Okay, talk about the abundance of information. The totally unchecked, unfettered flow of information and speech. no country does better than America. Okay, but do people make better decisions? Do they respect facts better, more? I don't think so.
You know, it's funny. I've been noticing more and more of this lately. I don't know, and I think I mentioned this in one of my previous shows. Chinese, you know, leaders, thought leaders, academics, whatever, going public with their very strident and critical views of the West and those who have been, you know, kind of crapping on them for about a decade. And they're, you know, some of these Chinese guys are now going public and, you know, firing back. This particular dude, his name is, he's a business entrepreneur. His name is Eric Li. He's at a Western journalist forum that was being held in Hong Kong. So these are all reporters from like France and the UK and the United States. And here he is taking on as well the notion that only they in the West, speaking to them, have fair and free elections.
In America, like I said, government turns bad, you recall it, the next one's just as bad or worse, and keeps going like this. There's no end to it. It's called elect and regret. And it's a continuous cycle of elect and regret. The numbers show that for decades. I mean, every time after an election, people regretted what they elected. That's not a good case.
Makes a good point. I can't remember the last time we had a president with more than 50% approval rating. Just saying. Then there's the question of the checks and balances. In the Constitution of the United States, it is beautifully drawn up, if I do say so myself. A principle created to make sure that no one part of the government is allowed to become too strong or too dominant over other parts of the government. But U.S. forefathers, you know, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, those guys, maybe they didn't plan for the special interests with money to burn, the billions, if not sometimes trillions, in these corporations that they use to become more powerful than any government entity, and even getting to the point where they kind of own the government.
Francis Fukuyama calls it vetocracy. Checks and balances are captured by special interests, and they capture the state. And vetocracy means that every interest group is strong enough to veto any political initiatives that are against their interests. But nobody could initiate and do something positive, and you get stuck. That's what checks and balances carry to the extreme do to your countries.
Here's the next question. Is the EU disintegrating? Is Western Europe flailing? Is NATO falling apart? Let's start with the news. France's prime minister, said to be President Macron's last chance at saving his gig, has fallen. He's out. And get this, the guy was only in the job for three and a half weeks. Even the BBC is calling the situation a governmental, and the word they use is a humiliation. Meanwhile, in Hungary, Viktor Orban is at it again. Asked if he would adopt the euro, he said, no, I don't want the euro, because the EU is falling apart. Hungary, like other EU members, are obliged to eventually join the eurozone, exception Denmark, by the way, which somehow secured an opt-out for themselves. But listen to this.
I think the problem lies with the European Union. I think the European Union is in the phase of disintegration. It is just starting to fall apart. And if there is no radical transformation of the Union in a couple of years, for which I do not see the capacity of the Union, neither from Brussels bureaucrats nor from the leading national states, I don't see any intention or ability from their bosses to do this. This process will continue, and the European Union will be a passing phase in our lives. This is why Hungary should not link its fate with the European Union in a stricter way than it does now. And its EU leadership would be the strictest link.
Wow. A passing phase in our lives, referring to the EU. That's a hell of a thing to say. Orban and other European leaders say they are plainly stating that they just don't want to align themselves anymore with with the EU. And by the way, it's not just the EU. Listen to what friend of this show, Scott Ritter, just said yesterday, or within the past 24 hours, what he has to say about NATO.
Well, NATO's been collapsing for a while. I mean, NATO, the collapse of NATO, one could say, began at its birth when it was created for no reason. So now we have NATO, you know, with militaries that can't fight, can't get out of the barracks, addicted to an American weapons, you know, supply chain, which has now been proven to be unreliable. Because what happens when America's ally, Israel, starts banging off weapons and needs it? The weapons get taken from other allies. NATO itself, you know, is part of a European elite that has committed economic suicide by delinking Europe from, you know, Russian energy.
That's our buddy Scott Ritter. And joining us now is Alex Cristoforo. You know, I've been trying to get this guy on the show for quite some time now, and we finally have been able to convince him to come on when he's not doing so much darn world traveling. He's amazing. I don't know if you've had a chance to watch his podcast, but he's really good at what he does. He's got something like, what, 250,000 subscribers and people following him all over the world. Graduated from William & Mary. By the way, one of the most beautiful campuses I have ever walked with my wife and my children. What a great place. He's a journalist. He's a geopolitical analyst. And he can talk to us about Europe, which was what we were just talking about, and also upcoming wars. I'm saying upcoming. I don't know, but look what's going on in Iran. Look what's going on in Venezuela right now. But hell, let's start with Europe, given what's going on there. Hey, Alex, so good to see you, my friend.
Hey, great to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
You really do a great job. You really do. You're fun to listen to. Let's start with Europe, because that's the last thing you were talking about on your podcast that I was watching. What do you make of what Mr. Orban says, and what do you make of this crazy development that just happened in France? You know, I've been fired from a lot of jobs. In fact, I'm known for being fired for saying things I probably shouldn't have said, but I've never been fired after 3.5 weeks.
Yeah. 27 days, right? My God. All Macron's fault, isn't it? It's all Macron's fault. I mean, if he had dealt with the problems that the French people need a president to deal with, he wouldn't be in this mess. But the problem with Macron and many of the leaders in Europe is that they don't want to deal with stuff that has to do with their country. They're just not interested. And I think that's doubly so for Macron. I mean, when you watch Macron interact with, which is very rare to see, but when he does interact with the people and the public, you can tell he's not interested. He doesn't like the job of president of France. He sees himself as something much bigger, the Jupiter, the little Napoleon of Europe, and his interests were the European Union, the globalist cause, Project Ukraine. This is the stuff that he's interested in. France to him was a nuisance, it seems. And over the past couple of weeks, he hasn't even been in France. He's been in Copenhagen and Germany and all over the place.
He sounds like between him and Zelensky, they're just kind of world travelers, you know? They're going out there to talk to people, maybe not so much in their own country. I do have to ask you this, though, because I was just reading what the BBC wrote, of all people, which surprises me. But the BBC has written somewhat critically of Macron, which, you know, the English and the French have always had this thing as well. But basically what they're saying, and what I want to ask you, is they're saying that this prime minister was supposed to be Macron's savior. So that is seeming to me an intimation that without this prime minister, Macron's on his way out. How soon?
Well, it was his best buddy, his biggest supporter, Le Carnot, his biggest advocate, this guy. And he was, and maybe still is, being groomed as the Macron replacement, right? So, you know, I think Le Carnot might have done something smart, interesting, in that he understood that the Macron administration doesn't have much road left, and I think he took the decision to step outside of the administration in order to not damage his own political future. So I think what he did might have been a pretty shrewd move, if you ask me, understanding that he could be positioned as the future president of France, saying, you know, I don't want this toxic Macron administration to reflect badly on my future. I don't want to put the budget and to put the policies up for a vote to the parliament, for the parliament to shoot it down. And that would be politically damaging for me going forward. So I think he just took the decision and said, I'm out, 5,000. I'm gone. Well, I'm not even going to put this up for a vote.
I love that. You sound so American. Audi 5,000. How cool. Yeah. Is what's happening in France emblematic of what's happening across Western Europe, i.e. EU?
Yeah, they're all unpopular, aren't they? All of them. I think if you combine Macron, Merz, and okay, you can put Starmer not in the EU, but he is reversing Brexit anyway, so you might as well just throw him in there as well. If you put them all together, I don't think they break 50% in approval rating and popularity.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they break 40%, to be quite honest. I mean, where Macron is effectively where Starmer is at the moment, and where Merz is heading very quickly. Merz just announced that that he wants to make the retirement age 73 in Germany. And the reason is because Germany's broke, doesn't have the money, but it has money for Project Ukraine. It has money for the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
But Merz is coming out and saying, you know what, as far as the pension system and the retirement funds, we don't have the money.
That's crazy. No money for people, but plenty of money for wars. That's crazy. Yeah. And they consistently send that message. So then Orban, with his comment that, look, we want nothing to do with the EU. We want nothing to do with the euro. Are others going to follow, you think? Slovakia and maybe a few others and maybe some factions inside even some of the countries that we were just talking about.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be crazy to go into the euro, if you want my opinion. I mean, I'm saying this as someone who comes from Greece and from Cyprus, right? The problems that we had in Greece in 2010 and then in Cyprus in 2013, if we were not tied into the euro, we would not have had the economic difficulties and the terrible austerity that we underwent. Once you're tied into the euro, that's it. That is it. I remember, you know, when we went through that austerity, whatever pushback we did give to the European Union as far as what cuts they wanted the Greek government to undertake, whenever we gave any kind of pushback, their reply to us was effectively, you know what, we control your money supply. There's going to be no money in the ATMs. So pick and choose. Which way do you want to go? Do you want to go with our austerity, or do you want people to be able to go to the bank machines and be able to pull out 100 euros, right? And then they impose capital controls and all these things. So, I mean, you know, you're giving away your sovereignty. What is a country if it doesn't control its currency? What is a country if it doesn't? It's not a country.
It's a province.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I feel bad for Bulgaria. Bulgaria in 2026 is going into the euro. Croatia adopted it about a year ago, and from what I understand, people are just upset about the whole experience with the euro. Obviously, prices go up; everything inflates. Orban is doing something very smart, something in Hungary's interests.
Yeah.
And that's going to really piss off Ursula in a big, big way, because the last thing that the technocrats in Brussels want to see is a country looking after its own national interests above the interests of the core, which is the Brussels headquarters.
But the people of Hungary voted for Orban. They did not vote for von der Leyen. They did not vote for Rutte. So why should they feel any kind of predisposition to listen to those people?
Has anyone voted for Ursula? Is there any voting process for her to be where she is?
That's the problem.
That's the problem, exactly. Well, the problem for citizens of Europe, for the globalist elite, it's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. They're not accountable to anybody. So they can keep on making whatever mistakes they make. and keep on failing over and over again. And who's going to hold them accountable? No one.
Yeah, that's kind of, in some strange measure, that's kind of what happens in my own country as an American. Because, yeah, we have fair and free elections. But when you think about it, you know, the elites choose the two people that we get to choose from. And they're both usually elitist types who have been funded to the tune of $500 million, $600 million. Dollars. So are they really being chosen by the people?
Most people will say no, but at least at a minimum, the people of the United States understand who the people in Washington are and where they need to go if they do have a grievance.
Yeah.
Right. If they're not happy, at least they know who to direct that dissatisfaction towards and who to complain towards.
Yeah.
Where if you're a European citizen, where do you go? Your government can't make decisions. Brussels is 3,000 miles away. I mean, what do you do? Where's your recourse? You have none.
That's really a great point. And well, then, okay, so let's go ahead and do this pantomime a little bit further, right? What happens if Europe does, as Mr. Orban says, will soon happen, disintegrate, fall apart, whatever the hell his word was that he used. What happens then from a global perspective? Because Europe lives off of its hate for Russia and China to a certain extent, but mostly Russia. And if they disintegrate, does that mean things open up for the people of Russia, who are really not bad people, despite what the West says about them?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, European elites are fueled off of this hatred for Russia, but the people are not. I mean, at least where I come from,
yeah.
Poll after poll shows that that the public is not hateful of Russia. Actually, it's the exact opposite. If you go to Greece and you go and see the recent polling, you'll see that Greeks overwhelmingly favor good relations with Russia. Hmm. You know, after all, we have a common a religion. We share a religion. It was very much even the alphabet is similar. The Cyrillic alphabet. I mean, you're talking about a very Greek influence with the Russian alphabet, with the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church. I mean, there's a lot of things that bind us to Russians. The same goes for Bulgarians. Who are Orthodox, even Romanian are of Orthodox religion. And if you go a little outside of the EU, you can look at Serbia as well. But, you know, the elites, they're on this this mission to take on Russia, to militarize the continent. It's a type of psychosis that has taken them over. I think most of the people, at least in Southern Europe, are not for this.
I'm kind of getting a sense from my sources and my antennas, my journalistic antennas, that there will soon be a rapprochement between the United States and Russia. That's what my gut is telling me, based on what I'm smelling. Do you agree?
Some days I say yes, some days I say no. Yeah. With Trump, you know, one day he comes out and says something which will lead you to think there's going to be a rapprochement, and then the next day he puts out a post on Truth Social which just goes completely opposite to what he said. I'm having a hard time trying to understand what foreign policy Trump is following, if there's any foreign policy at all to the Trump administration. To be quite honest, it seems to me like Trump just repeats the last thing he heard from someone in his administration. Whatever he hears last is kind of what he throws out there. So if Lindsey Graham is whispering in his ears when they were playing golf, the next day you could have a post on Truth Social about how the United States is ready to send missiles to Ukraine. I mean, it's that type of foreign policy that I think the Trump administration has. I don't think they've quite gotten on top of their foreign policy going forward for the next 3.5 years.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Foreign policy, Trump administration. First two things that come to mind, based on what I've been reading in the last 24 hours, are two countries, actually. Interesting. Iran, once again, and Venezuela, I guess, once again. what do you make of the news coming out of Venezuela with Mr. Maduro basically saying that there's a false flag in the works that the U.S. is going to use to then have a pretense for attacking Caracas?
Yeah. I mean, you know, a false flag. I don't even think we need a false flag anymore. I mean, you know, I think it's pretty obvious what the Trump White House is moving towards. The New York Times even had an article yesterday where they said that that all diplomatic initiatives with Venezuela have been cut off. So Richard Grenell was speaking with Maduro. The New York Times was reporting that Grenell was trying to talk Maduro into some sort of stepping down or stepping aside, and then getting a new government in place, and then the oil going to the United States. They were talking about stuff like that, and Richard Grenell was trying to liaise with the Maduro administration to try to avoid some sort of a conflict, and it came to nothing. And so the Trump administration, they've decided to cut off whatever diplomatic initiatives they have with Venezuela. And to me, that seems like this was the last part of any type of off-ramp to a conflict. So, you know, the pieces are in place for something to happen in Venezuela. Some sort of a regime change operation, some sort of decapitation operation. The Washington Examiner was reporting that what the United States is going to do is they're going to try and take over critical infrastructure like airfields and ports and stuff like that and force some sort of a regime change. And we don't know what forces are within Venezuela, which could be working with the United States once all of this kicks off as well. I mean, something's going to happen. When it's going to happen, I think it's going to be fairly soon. And what the effects of that are going to be, I think are going to be disastrous. But we're going to have to wait and see.
You know, I don't know what your experiences are, but I'll tell you what mine are in covering these things and actually living in a country that's gone through this type of thing, being Cuban. More often than not, when a foreign power goes into a country, what they do is they coalesce the people of that country around their leadership. Even those who can't stand the leadership all of a sudden become defensive and defend that leader. I was talking to Morandi over the weekend about that, and he said he's never seen so many young people all of a sudden, you know, get behind the government of Iran. And in fact, we just saw recently, you saw it, I'm sure, all the people taken to the streets in Caracas saying we're behind our president. So that's often what I mean, that's my fear. You know, you're just creating a bigger conflagration.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, but Did the neocons ever think like that?
No.
Do they ever think one or two steps ahead, or do they ever think, you know, maybe something could go wrong, or the people are coalescing around Maduro? Maybe we should call off some sort of an operation. We don't see a type of grassroots movement against him. They never think like that. I mean, you know, we say it often on our podcast. They have no reverse gear. Once they've decided on one option and only one option, you know, they move forward and they don't think of how the thing can go off the rails. They for some reason they don't have the capacity to think like that. They've decided on it, and it looks like they're going to move forward on some sort of an operation in Venezuela.
Wouldn't it be nice if they had someone like Doug McGregor running the Defense Department? Wouldn't that be incredible? I mean, an experienced man who's lived a real life and reads tons of books and understands military history?
Well, the system will never allow it. The system will just throw out someone like this. It's impossible to get into the blob, into the system, if you're that type of leader.
Yeah, they'd rather have a Macron type, right?
Yeah, a Macron. I mean, Macron goes through the system. He goes through the assembly line, right? And then he gets placed into the system, straight into it. You can't have someone like McGregor. Even Trump, who has now integrated into the system to a certain extent, he was seen as too much of an outsider in his first term. And we saw the Russiagate scandal and all the things that were thrown at Trump. And And I would say that, yes, he has an outsider quality, but he also has an insider quality as well. But can you imagine someone completely on the outside like McGregor, or has a different different thought process to the world than all of these guys?
And that's funny, because when I talk to Doug, I know he speaks to the president. They're friends. They've known each other for many years, and he has relied upon him in the past. And I'm wondering, based on what you just said, think about what you just said for a moment. You were talking about how Trump tried to go away from those folks in his first term, but it doesn't look like on this term he's able to do it as much. And, you know, I've been around horses a little bit in my life. My wife and I have a farm, a ranch down in Florida, and I know what it takes to break a horse, right? And it's like, you got to be very disciplined with it. Yeah. I'm almost getting a sense that Mr. Trump has been broken this time around.
Yeah, well, you're right about that, from the sense of Russiagate was devastating. I mean, when you take a look back at his first term and everything connected to Russiagate, not only did it do a lot of damage to Trump, but in a way, it has also brought us to where we are with the conflict in Ukraine and the relations between the United States and Russia. Mm. Russiagate was horrific in on many, many levels. I can't imagine what effect it had on Trump, and it's definitely had effect on relations between the United States and Russia.
And it was a horrific lie,
a stupid lie,
made up.
Was dumb. When you take a step back and think about what they were saying, it was beyond dumb. Right. Trump was some sort of puppet of the crazy. It was beyond stupid.
You
had to be very low IQ to believe it.
Even their charges against Russia. I mean, if at worst what Russia did is they got a bunch of advertising on Facebook and said horrible things about Hillary Clinton. Are you kidding me? That's
it. Yeah, the whole thing was dumb. Yeah, I agree. But you know, it proves the power of the media and the power of propaganda, at least back then.
Or stupid reporters.
Stupid reporters, reporters who are part of the system.
Yeah.
They're just going to repeat whatever the script before them is.
What was that line in the Godfather? They suck me in.
Yeah, and every time I tried to get out, they
suck me back in. Yeah, and I almost get a sense that reporters in the corporate media, they're sucked in, man. They got cushy jobs. They make good money. They get to wear makeup every day and go stand in front of a camera, and somebody gives them a story. He says, "Oh, Trump is tied to Russia." Okay, I'll go with that. It's like they have no reason to go against something like that.
It's like the thinking muscle has just kind of atrophied.
Yeah,
and they don't even use it after a certain amount of years in the business. Maybe when they were young and you know they had energy and they were excited about going into journalism or reporting, maybe they were thinking. But then over the years, I guess it just kind of atrophied, and now they're just given the talking points, and they just buy into it and they repeat it, and that's that.
Yeah, and if you watched my interview when I was sitting around talking to Tucker, I remember Tucker said, "You were fired from CNN because you said the wrong things, right?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "And you were fired from Fox News because you said the wrong things." He said, "Absolutely."
That's how it works. Yeah. You have to conform to the system. And it's not about 99% conformity or 99.9. It has to be 100%. You have to be 100% on board to the agenda. To me, it very much is a religion. It has the sense, it has the feel, the makeup of a religion, and you have to take part in all the sacraments, and you have to be signed up and believe 100% in the ideology and the cause.
Well, speaking of religion, boom, right into that. Yeah. Speaking of religion and speaking of control of the media, let's talk a little bit about Israel. Because it's starting to look, not that they in any way control the media, by the way. I have no idea where the hell I got that idea. But why does it seem to me that they're pushing once again to hit Iran? And I'm getting a sense that the United States may be listening to them a little more than I wish they would be on that matter. What is your take?
Yeah, I think Iran round two is going to happen, most likely by the end of the year. And I think most analysts are pretty much on board with that take as well, that in Iran round two is going to happen. I think the window that that they think they have as far as destabilizing Iran. They believe that that it's closing, right? So Iran has certain agreements with Russia, certain agreements with China. It's in BRICS, and so they believe, look, if we're going to finally do this regime change or this balkanization of Iran, you know, the time frame that we have is say 6 months to maybe a year tops. And I think the Trump administration is probably thinking along the lines of midterms and these type of things happening in the United States. And they're saying, you know what, we need to get something put together by around the end of the year, because if we don't, then we're going to be heading straight into midterms, and that's going to be very bad for the Republicans. So my guess, and I think a lot of analysts are saying, you know, probably around that time frame of December, give or take, is when we might see a round two. I mean, that's a guess, but you know, I think that the general consensus is around that time frame.
But you know, I'm just thinking, because of what I was talking about earlier today with my viewers, which you may or may not have been privy to, the American people are changing. Their BS antennas are a little more receptive these days. And whereas it was easy to convince us to go to war with Iraq by lying to us and telling us that there were weapons of mass destruction, which they weren't, and that somehow Iraq was tied to the 9/11 thing, which it wasn't. And in other cases, we have obviously been lied to by our government. This time, to go to war with Iran, they're going to have to come up with a real whopper, because everybody in the United States knows the score. And the score is, right now, if we go to war with Iran, it's only because Bibi Netanyahu told us we have to do so. That's the thinking inside the United States. How do you change that? Because that's not a healthy thing for any administration to have its citizens thinking of them.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I wonder if the Trump administration or Trump himself even understands this. You know, I go back to the position he's taken, say, for example, with Epstein. And it seems like he doesn't have an understanding about the MAGA America First, which he claims that he's the leader of MAGA, right? Trump says, this is my movement, so I'm the heart and soul of MAGA. This is how Trump sees himself. But it seems like he's kind of out of touch with where America First or MAGA is at the moment, at least on certain issues. Some issues he's very much in touch with America First, but other issues it seems like he's out of touch with them. Well, and I think foreign policy, he could be out of touch with that.
Well, that would be contrary to everything that he is. I mean, he's a marketing guy. He's a business person. The one thing that I think makes people in business, and in particular in marketing, good, it's called reading the room. Reading the room. You've got to be able to read and understand how you're being taken, how you're being perceived at any given moment, so you can give them the right data or the right stimuli, right? And if he doesn't do that right, I mean, I would think that he would be good at this. Like, he could go, oh, no, I don't want to do that because that's not going to go well with my people. So you're right. It is kind of ironic that if he's not good at this, it's ironic that he's not good at this.
Yeah, it seems like it's on certain issues he's good at it, like say the border,
right?
Okay, he's good, or even with the social issues, say, you know, with the woke stuff, he was very good on it, and then he got rid of all the woke things very quickly, right? The whole woke feeling and sentiment in the United States went away in a couple of months, and everything kind of changed. I mean, on these things, he seems to be in tune. But when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to say, Zelensky, when it comes to Gaza and to Netanyahu, it seems like he's out of touch. Epstein is another example. For some reason, he's unable to read the room. You get the same feeling when it comes to negotiations. You know, he's the great negotiator, isn't he? What is he really negotiated? I mean, the Liberation Day tariffs or stuff like that has been a complete flop. All of it is, you know, you had all these tariffs and he was going to negotiate all these deals. I'm going to negotiate with 100 countries. I don't even know. He's negotiated with what, one or two? No. The European Union which is not really a negotiation. That's someone dictating to the vassals what to do. I mean, he's off step on many things. Some things he's spot on, but other things it seems like he doesn't have that energy that he had in his first term, which was derailed by the whole Russiagate thing.
Do you agree with a lot of people who think it's in fact that kind of belligerence and bullying, if you want to call it that, a word that's been used before in terms of how he's treated countries when it comes to tariffs? Best example of that, I think, is India. Do you think it's because of that we're seeing such a new and important union developing in these Global South countries and in these BRICS countries, especially what we saw recently in Shanghai between Mr. Modi, Mr. Xi, and Mr. Putin?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on that. I mean, I think the whole tariff thing, you know, as a policy, whether you agree with tariffs in the way that Trump originally wanted to use them to bring back manufacturing to the United States, right? That was the stated goal. Mm. Whether you believe that's a right economic policy or right reindustrialization policy, everyone has a different opinion, but it's a policy.
It's a great
idea. Strategy.
No, he's right.
It's a strategy.
Yeah.
He didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
They became a weapon. And they became a weapon because for some weird reason, which I can't figure out, he once again fell prey to this neocon faction in D.C. that whisper in his ear and they tell him, Mr. President, you can weaponize the tariffs. We can use the tariffs to gain leverage over India and gain leverage over China and gain leverage on countries so that they don't buy Russian oil and do all of these things. And he bought into that. And so you had an interesting strategy, interesting policy that Trump was talking about before he became president and something that he put in place during the first months of his presidency, which a lot of people, including myself, were interested in seeing how it would unfold if it was done right and if it was done correctly. But as with everything that happens in D.C., doesn't matter who the president is, it gets weaponized and usually gets weaponized for the military-industrial complex, for wars, by the neocons, whether it's sanctions, whether it's tariffs. There's no difference between tariffs and sanctions anymore. There's no difference. It's just another weapon that they use now in order to get some sort of foreign policy leverage over a country.
Just another castigatory measure. Yeah. So where are you off to next?
I don't know. I'm gonna probably plan my next trip in the next day or two. I'll probably figure out which country I will be off to next. Yeah. It depends on what's going on in the world, and maybe I could go somewhere where there's some action going on.
You know, you and I share that. I mean, people ask me sometimes, some of my friends back home, why are you there? And I tell them that the import of access, the ability to be in a place, look at it, talk to the people, talk to the leaders, get interviews with people that Americans would never get an opportunity to meet. Tonight, I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to St. Petersburg, and I'm going to talk to one of Russia's assistant prime ministers. And I'm going to head up an economic forum and talk to a lot of the people in this country who have things to do, not just this country, but other countries in the region that have to do with economy. I wouldn't be able to do that if I was doing the news on CNN or Fox. I'd just be talking about Nancy Pelosi every night or somebody like that, you know?
I think that's a great point that you're making, because one of the reasons we're in the mess that we're in is because we don't have people like yourselves, but not in the journalist field, but say in the foreign policy diplomatic field or the analysis field, who are in countries like Russia and they are on the ground to try and get a clear understanding as to what is going on. We've lost that. I think you have a lot of analysts now who are just on a computer.
Yes.
And they're just browsing the internet. And they're saying, okay, let's base our policy on this video that I saw or this article that I read from someone as I was browsing the internet. I think this is where a lot of DC finds itself. And this is a huge mistake because, you know, you're never going to be able to replace people in the location seeing what's going on, feeling what's going on, getting a sense for everything that is happening, and then getting it back to the government and saying, look, guys,
yes,
this is not the right way to go about things. I'm telling you, I'm here on the ground. Yeah. I'm telling you, this is not what's going on. And DC has lost that. And it's no secret that the first thing that Brussels did with the sanctions is they cut off the travel to Russia, to and from Russia, because they want to try to separate the people so that we lose the understanding of one another.
Mm-hmm. Obviously it's horrible with Russia because the lies and the misunderstanding about Russia and China, and to a certain extent, countries like India and other countries in Southeast Asia, is just phenomenal. But I would even argue most Americans, because of the media, they have no idea what the hell is going on in Greece, right?
Yeah.
They do a story out of Greece once a year, and that's if there's a riot or something funny, yeah, or sometimes a presidential election. That's it. Nothing from a cultural standpoint, nothing from an ideological standpoint, nothing from a religious standpoint. They have no idea what the hell is going on. And that's one of your allies. So you can only imagine then, right? I think that's why what you're doing is so important. I mean, you don't only tell the stories, but you tell them from the places from where you're reporting. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Just so people can even see the streets that you're walking on, what they're like, and to see the people that are walking around and hanging out. You know, people can see the videos and they can say, you know, it looks pretty cool there. Or yeah, the people look like me, or they're normal. Mm. Or, you know, they're just hanging out at a coffee shop as you're walking by.
Yeah.
I think people see that and they get a sense of, you know, why are we at war? Why are we arguing? Or why do we have these sanctions again? What's the reasoning?
A lot of them are probably saying, how come we got homeless tents and there's no homeless tents behind him there?
A lot of people do ask those very questions. Why are the streets clean?
Oh.
You know, why do we have, you know, trash or graffiti on our streets and they don't?
They don't have it here. Yeah, they don't have it here. I know. It's funny that way. Alex, you're a delight, man. I'm so glad we had a chance to get to know each other here on the air, and hopefully one day we'll be able to meet up and have a drink or something, maybe
look
even an adult beverage. Thank you, my friend. I really enjoyed the time and the company. Take good care, and let's stay in touch. All right?
You too. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Take care.
That's it. And that's it for us. Hey, thanks so much for being with us. As you heard me mentioning to Alex just a little while ago, tomorrow we're going to have a show for you, but I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to be going to St. Petersburg. In fact, we're going to probably leave, I think, sometime tonight. Should be good. I'm going to be bringing you back something pretty special, interviews that, like I said to him, we wouldn't normally be able to bring you unless we had access to some of these folks so we can ask them some of the tough questions. Also, my podcast, Journalistically Speaking, please check it out. It's pretty cool. We'll get cuts from my conversation with Alex, and we'll have him on there as well. And then on Rick Sanchez TV, yep, that's also where I hang out. And there we have really fun, important conversations. We'll be looking for you next time right here on The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks for letting us into your home.